6:51 p.m. Time to start wrapping up your work and plan for dinner.
Dan, that must be, are you my Dan? Like my speaker Dan?
Yeah, I'm having some audio issues on my end.
Did you just say something, Dan? Hey, Michael. Unmute and say hi, Mike Teeter. I mean, Mike T. I mean, Mike.
And I cannot hear you. I don't know if it's just me or if everybody can't hear you.
Can you hear me, Mike? Mike, can you hear me?
Oh, there, I hear you a little bit.
Weird.
Let me check if I got something wrong here.
No.
Now my volume's at 51, which is really loud. So I don't know why I'm not hearing.
Mike, can you hear me? Why does Mike act like he can't hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay.
You're not real loud, but I can.
So if I'm not real loud,
Of course, I don't need. Yeah.
what could be the problem?
Michael is blasting me loud, and I can just barely hear you, Anne. Probably down in your microphone adjustments at the lower left corner of the screen, the little up arrow there, and go to audio settings. And then you'll have microphone adjustment.
Settings. Sound settings. Okay. Sound settings. Now, what do I do?
I can't hear you, but down in the lower left corner of the screen, there's audio, and right next to it, there's the little up arrow thing. You click that, and then there's like this thing,
I'm in something right now called audio
audio setting.
settings. I'm in system sound. Is that where I'm supposed to be? I'm going to just share my screen. How about that? Let me share my screen and you can see what I'm doing. So here's what I'm looking at right now. Oh, input, is it input?
Oh, see the microphone? It's way down at 8. Try running it up to full.
Okay, can you hear me better?
Much better. Yes.
Yay! Hey, I just learned something. Okay, so you go to settings, audio, input. Huh, I wonder what turned it down. Like, does it just turn itself down sometimes?
Well, there's a setting in, I mean, it's the same setting, only it's easier to get to directly in Zoom.
Okay.
In Zoom, where the little audio microphone in the lower left corner of your Zoom window, bottom at the bottom left, there's a little up arrow right next to the audio.
Yep, I see it.
The bottom most choice is audio setting.
Audio settings. And that gets me to exactly where I just was.
It's a different dialogue, but it's the same settings.
Okay.
And there's
All
even
right.
a test to test your speakers and test your microphone.
Yep, I see that.
Okay.
Oh, that's really good information. So if this ever happens when you're not on a call and I have to help somebody do it, maybe I would remember how. Anything is possible. Okay. So we got 5 minutes left. So Mike, are you still there? Maybe not. Hey, Mike, catch me up on your life. I haven't seen you in a while.
Well, I've pretty much just been enjoying retirement and, you know.
Riding your Harley?
Well, I got an Indian now.
Oh, okay.
But, I mean.
Are you riding it?
Not as much as I wanted.
Okay.
But my goal was 10,000 miles a season. I made about.
Per season?
Yeah.
Holy shit. I put less than that on my car in the entire year. And you want to do four times that?
Well, wow. I figured the riding season is roughly 4 months. You know, so. But, you know, between Marshall and my mom and my kids, it just, it's life.
Nice. Well, I went to the NARSAL conference in Atlanta, the one that the Proud Boys threatened, you know, when we were supposed to be in Michigan, the Proud Boys threatened the hotel and said they were going to pitch a big fit. And so then the hotel just canceled on us. Well, they rescheduled it. We went back to the same place in Atlanta that we had been to before. And they were the Proud Boys never showed up. We didn't see one ounce of them. We paid extra. We had two uniformed cops there all the whole time we were there. So Thursday night, all day Friday, all day Saturday, and half of Sunday, we paid for cops to work the booths or work the event. And then on top of that, NARSAL had two people who they just, I guess, probably had to volunteer. Eric and Chris just sat there with these security t-shirts on the entire time and didn't get to attend the conference or interact with people. So that just pissed me off because we should be allowed to have a conference without people pitching a fit. Anyway, the conference was great. I went to a lot of really good workshops. And then on Sunday morning, I got up on stage with the Shine Voices girls and we gave a presentation basically about this new organization called WASH, Women Against Sexual Harm. The four of us took turns sharing. What she asked us to share was what information, if you had had it at the time, would have made your crime not happen. You know, what information would have been helpful for you to know? And so we all just said our little stories and it was very well received. People seemed to like it.
So is WASH about the women that are victims or women perpetrators or both?
Well, WASH is led by the Shine Voices sisters. Shine Voices are women forced to register. They're women who created who got accused of a sexual crime and, you know, a lot of them served time for it or whatever. And Shine Voices, I don't remember what Shine stands for. It's a lot of words. Anyway, the Shine Voices women decided that, you know, for 30 years we've been fighting the registry, but no one's ever made any, the anti-registry movement has never really said, let's try to find a way to stop this from happening from the start. And so that was the premise was, you know, we, the women and you know, the people who have committed a crime know what they were thinking at that time. And, you know, maybe we should share some of the things that we knew. So I, of course, didn't have, you know, I'm not a Shine Voices girl. So I didn't have this would have stopped me from committing my crime thing to share. But so instead I just shared, you know, what could have prevented the things that happened to me when I was a kid. And then I went into basically my connections to the registry and said, you know, here are the things that parents should know about raising teenagers, right? If I had known this years ago, my daughter would have been safer. She didn't end up getting put in the registry, but she could have been. And So, you know, it's like never let your kid take their phone in their bedroom. That's just dumb. Because kids and phones is like, that's called how to make porn. Oh, you just use this phone, this camera thing here, right here. Anyway, oh, it's 7:01. Okay, so I'm going to introduce our speaker. Dan, are you gonna share your screen with us? I would love it if you did.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me on.
There we go. All right. So this is Dan. Apparently, there are things that I have not had a long enough conversation with Dan. What I know about Dan is that his dad and I actually exchange letters. See if I could find the most recent letter. Yes, here it is. So his dad was charged with like nine things like 27 years ago. And he has appealed and won his appeal on, I think, six of those things, but they are still holding him in pre-trial detention for something they charged him with 27 years ago. He's in pre-trial detention for the trial that never happens because they just want to keep him locked up forever. Anyway, so that's his dad, and his dad's name, I'm losing it, Daniel.
Richard.
Richard. So Richard is currently serving. He's currently incarcerated in a shadow prison in Washington State, although I think he's been in a bunch of different places during these 27 years. And from inside, he Richard created this with I'm sure with his son's help, created this organization called A Touch of Light. And A Touch of Light basically lets people inside of prison situations make art, and then they go have like galleries and whatever you call it when you show people art. So, with no more ado, no more dawdling, Dan, take it away. Tell us all the things you want to tell us about all the things.
Thank you, Anne. You pretty much laid out the broad strokes. Dad and I started working on A Touch of Light, oh gosh, almost 15 years ago now. And that organization is kind of we are kind of cautious in who we choose. And the caution principally being that we want to represent the very finest artwork that people are able to create inside of their circumstance. And so generally that has been very well received. We've done a number of art shows across the country. We've done an art show in Kenya as part of a larger conference that was going on. This was in 2023 with Cure. And we're gearing up for another one. If everything comes together in the next couple of weeks, in Asia. And
So Cure operates in what country was that?
so Cure,
Kenya?
the Charlie Sullivan's organization, out of Washington, D.C., they hold an international conference every couple of years. And the
Oh.
most recent international conference was held in Kenya. They
Okay.
don't have offices there, to my knowledge, since they are a US-based organization.
But do they like are they available to, I mean, do they have Kenyans that are paying attention?
Yeah, there's basically like a Kenyan branch of Cure that was operating at least for a year or two. I was invited to sit the board of that organization. It's
Because yeah, I mean that
interesting.
it happens in all people in all countries
Right.
struggle with the things that we struggle with here, and that's really
Right.
cool that you can.
Kenya has a lot of holdover laws from the British colonial era that were basically designed to sweep people up and keep them from forming riotous mobs is kind of how it was explained to me. But now they're used to extort people that mostly young people that don't have any money. So they'll roll up on someone and say, well, hey, it's against the law to be unemployed on this corner. So you need to give me a dollar and you can go. Kid doesn't have a dollar. Boom. Charged, now they're in prison. The whole, I mean, this is was explained to me is like this is an extremely common thing over
Wow.
there. So different places, different problems, but prison still endures wherever you go. So what we've really been able to find in working with artists and working with arts programs kind of globally is the human spirit endures as well, despite horrific conditions, despite gross disparities in types of treatment, the ability to pick up even something as simple as a pencil or
Yeah.
one of those little floppy anti-suicide pins that they give you in the hall and sketch something or make something, you know, produce some kind of creative outlet or output from the, you know, all of that time that you have on your it is consistently reported. And we've had conversations with folks running these kind of the programs in Australia, even correctional officers that have gone around and done the one lady out of yeah, I believe it was Australia, had actually done a world tour of other arts programs in various countries to kind of get a sense of how they might bring back the best practices to her facility. And they did some academic type of level of research on it. And people need to have the opportunity to express themselves. And, you know, there's a art therapy has become sort of an in vogue term, I would say, but there really is a degree of out processing.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, when a person sits down and has the freedom to let their mind wander over the page or wander over the clay or the paintbrush or whatever, and see what comes out of that. When we went to the Basilica of Saint Mary in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and we did a exhibition there, and we partnership with a local program there, we had stories. We had basically commentary from some of the artists through their affiliate organization saying, look, this I'm a significantly changed person from where I was when I came into prison to where I was when I started, you know, involving in this program into now where I am, where I'm actually not just a functional artist, but a competent, where I'm producing quality pieces of art that people now, you know, either they want to purchase them or they at least want to see them. And something that I have noticed, I'm sure my dad has noticed it as well. There's been a lot of occasions where, and this is a story that my dad has relayed to me. You know, there at one point, one of the facilities, because my dad's got a long background in business and various other things. He's got a pretty good eye for, you know, things that people would probably like. He's done marketing, he's done this. And when word kind of got around, oh, that's the guy with the organization. Well, now the artists come flocking out of the room. Everybody wants to drive by the table with, let me show you this, let me show you that, whatever, whatever. And he said, you know, Dan, I was sitting there and I got these three or four guys crowding around. I want to show me what they're doing. And I see this other guy who's too shy to come to the table. And he said, you know, like, okay, thanks, guys. You know what? I'll give it some thought. Hey, man, you know, come here. Since you don't want to walk up, come here, man. Show me what you got. That guy turned out to be one of our top artists.
Wow.
And my dad calls it rag picking. Sometimes you got to look and have the ability to find the right rag out of the bundle that's going to be right for the purpose that you need. And that guy didn't think that he had good art. He didn't think he was, he didn't really think that he himself was worth much as a person, but he really had not a lot of regard for his capacity as an artist or the quality of work that he was already producing. Now, I've seen, we've been representing him for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years now, and I've seen the development of skill set over that, because I can look at the pieces that he originally sent to us, and I look at more recent stuff, and I go, this is, there's a very clear gradient of increase in talent, increase in capability, color use, the brushstroke, all of it. And we try to, you know, we try to communicate that as much as we can to say, hey, man, you know,
back when to the artist.
Yeah, when I have the privilege of getting a chance to actually sell someone's work, they're the first person the first person I tell is my dad. But the artist is usually the second person, or at least their family, whoever I can get a hold of first.
Yeah, whoever you can reach.
Yeah, because it's important to know, you know, listen, financial concern aside, somebody saw what you produced. They knew that it was produced by a prisoner, because we don't hold back the fact that that's who we are as an organization. And so the work that you see is produced by people that are incarcerated. It's not a secret. So someone came to your piece of art with that knowledge and chose you. Nobody else has chosen you. And maybe your social set, your family, your friends, your neighborhood that you came with, whoever, wherever you came from, maybe they have all thrown you away because of what you did, because of where you are, etc. But this person, knowing that you're inside, said, you know what, that's a piece of quality that I want to put in my house. And that little bit, there's so little recognition of people's humanity.
Yeah.
On the inside.
That is absolutely true.
And
especially in the shadow prisons.
Yeah.
Like, it's worse in a shadow prison by a factor of, you know,
correct.
Quite a few, I haven't been in either, but you know, the stories that I hear make it sound like shadow prisons are, you know, one flew over the cuckoo's nest.
They're an entirely different capacity. Even my dad, when he talks about the things that go on a day-to-day basis, this is kind of my reaction. I am mostly always at a loss of what to say.
Yeah.
Because of the degree of everything, whether it comes down to intentional, targeted, constitutionally violational abuse from staff who are clearly aware that they're violating someone's human rights by their behavior, or all the way to the other end of the spectrum, where you have folks that unfortunately have been so broken by life in their minds and their spirits and their behavioral patterns and everything else that they fell below the floor, and no one knows that they're there. If they did know, they don't care. And that person, you know, the ones that are really in a pretty badly mentally damaged state, don't have the capacity to climb back up by themselves.
Yeah, they certainly don't get effective. They don't have the capacity to climb back up when the people around them aren't helping.
Correct.
Right. You know.
Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, I get almost a daily report from my father about behaviors that set aside whether or not they would be acceptable out here in the community, they wouldn't be acceptable in a minimum security prison. Because he's done time in minimum security prisons.
Are you talking about behaviors from the people running the place or behaviors from,
both.
People?
Both. Both. Yeah, even there are lines even the Department of Corrections understands we don't tread here. That's a bridge too far. These little, you know, gulags, they fly under a different set of rules. And it is staggering to me. And the reason that they're allowed to maintain from the staff side those kinds of things is because no one, Frank, forgive my language, but no one gives a damn about it. Or women. Yeah. I think we had at least one woman in this state who was assigned to this same facility years and years ago. Voluntarily, too. I looked up her story and I was shocked. She voluntarily submitted herself and they were like, cool, we own you now for, I think, 30 or 40 years before she was 30 years old when she was admitted to this facility. They didn't release her until her mid-60s. And I don't know the entire circumstances. You know, her case came along, I think, back in the 80s. So I have no idea the specifics there. But my God, was that requisite to situation?
Yeah.
You know, there's... The cruel and unusual punishment clause, which I've gone and looked on your website, Anne, and looked on NART. I mean, we are talking about treatment. We are talking about a carceral condition that goes far and above deterrence, far and above equitable punishment for whatever the crime happened to be. The
right,
Department of Corrections
be
was the punishment.
Right. They're claiming that they're not punishment. They're claiming that they're therapeutic. You know, I've had a number of speakers. So we had Ruby and Tiffany from End MOSOP talk about they've done people on the outside have done protests outside that facility, and they've had people on the inside doing hunger strikes. You know, they've really worked hard, this and MOSOP people. Anyway, they came on once. I had a lady from the Larned facility in Kansas come on. She was a therapist named Thaisa Carvalho Mick. She worked there for 4 months, 5 months. She said very early in her working with these men, they said, oh, you're too nice. They're not going to let you stay. You're too nice to us. You treat us with compassion. Treat us like we're human beings. Start taking notes because they're going to fire you. Just
correct.
Start
there's
making
a,
taking notes.
There's
sure
a term
enough,
that they.
Sure enough, 5 months later. So this was during COVID. So they basically claimed that they didn't have a mask small enough for her small face, and they said because we don't have a mask, you're just going to have to go home. So Thaisa was like, I can't leave these men with no therapist. Like, they need me. I'm making progress with them. So she went to the local hospital, and the hospital gave her a fancier mask that was perfect for her face. So she comes back to work, and they basically wrote her up for violating the rule that they said, you can't come to work because you don't have the right mask. She got written up for that. And then eventually she got fired. She, since leaving there, she's made a number of videos that she's posted, like, on YouTube about it. You know, she'll go on and on. She's gone and talked to the Kansas legislators, you know, trying to say, like, I'm a therapist. I know what's therapeutic. And I know that the things that I was being paid to do with these men isn't remotely therapeutic. Like, one of the things she had to do every time someone got a magazine or the facility got a magazine, she would have to sit with someone and cut out all the tiny pictures of any children in the magazine, anything that was children, she had to have them cut it out. She's like, if you're trying to help a person grow past something, this isn't it. This is not making them healthier or better. Similarly, when they'd go to Walmart, she said if you advanced in your treatment or whatever and got high enough, whatever rating, they would take you to Walmart for a trip. She said these trips were so traumatic for the men, because basically the staff would be there. And let's say you're shopping in the cereal aisle, and you're busy picking out cereal, and you don't notice that a family with kids walks into that aisle from the end. If you don't immediately like freak out and leave the aisle where the child is, you get knocked down a peg, so you can't come to Walmart next time. So she said a lot of the guys would just like sit in the van. They just took the outing because they were allowed to have it, but they were afraid to go inside because going inside would basically steal the thing that they worked hard to gain.
From what I've told, we have, I forget the precise term, there are houses here in the community in Washington State that are basically exclusively for, I like the term shadow prison, shadow prisoners who have sort of been released to the community, but not really. They're not allowed to talk to anybody. They're not allowed to talk to anyone, as far as I'm aware, who doesn't actually live in a house with them. And if they do, they can be violated and sent back.
Yeah. So the thing that every human being needs, connection to other human beings,
right?
We're going to deny you that.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I do not have a clinical background. I don't have a therapeutic background, but show me where in the therapeutic literature that is realistic and is well accepted practice anywhere where it's accepted that preventing someone from learning how to develop pro-social, healthy communicatory skill sets, boundaries with other people, etc. You know, many of these men and women that are in these situations are at least partly there because they didn't have the right social boundaries at the right time.
Right.
And
yes,
teaching them to flee from everybody in sight does not promote that kind of growth. So you've taken a person and you've said effectively, you are not a person, because people have the ability in varying capacities, but okay, to grow, to modify their behavior, to engage in my favorite Greek term of the last year or two is metanoia, changing their mind and changing their behavior and changing their identity.
Mm-hmm.
And what you've said is, no, no, no. We are classifying you as a person who is incapable of doing these things. You just need to be managed as a non-person. And that's it.
Yep.
And it is, at the root of it, it is un-American. Absolutely. Before we begin to talk about violation of human rights, basic human decency, and destroying a person whose life has already mostly destroyed them. You're pouring salt on a person whose entire skin is ripped off and may never recover fully. Some of the stories that I've heard from some of the men at my father's facility, I just sit back and I wonder, you know, how much better could things have been if things had been for your life? Because I've seen plenty of people come out of prison, get engaged with their communities, start building up their skill sets as a person, as someone who's civically involved, educationally involved, employed. They took their time. They reflected on whatever brought them into an incarcerated state in the first place. And they made a choice. They made an opportunity out of the cards that they were given. And they've done well. And most of these folks in this specific kind of situation They're just simply not. I don't see that they're given those opportunities in the first place.
Yeah.
And the environment that they are in presently absolutely does not encourage it. You are a warm body hooked up on a matrix feed. Make sure that the cash flow that we are getting, because you have to be here, continues to flow. That's your only reason for existence in this place.
Yep. Yep.
It's,
yeah.
I am, because I've seen what my father has suffered in this area particularly, let me take it one step further. Because my father has always maintained his innocence from day one. That you're not allowed to do that.
Yeah, exactly. You're not going to ever level up on any of the things that they want.
Correct. Because
the first part of any one of those therapies is, you know, admitting you're a bad guy.
Right. And it's so if you are in such a position as my dad is, where no, this is not correct. This is not true to begin with.
Yeah.
And every piece of paperwork that DOC has layered up over years and years and years is contrary to the facts.
Yep.
Well, but these are all trusted law enforcement people. They wouldn't lie about this. That's ridiculous.
No, 100% they would lie about this.
And for a person, for an innocent person, finds themselves not just in prison necessarily, but kicked all the way to the bottom of this pile. It is a world unlike any of us know or really can understand without being in it.
Yeah.
And I think it is, it's a black mark on every state who operates one of these places.
Absolutely.
It is horrifically destructive. Obviously, it's destructive to the people that are forced to reside there. It's destructive to the people that work there, too.
It's destructive to
people
who work there. It's destructive to anyone.
The turnover rate is outrageous. And if you got that kind of a turnover rate, and that kind of, you've got a higher turnover than DOC. People don't want to work at DOC either.
Nope.
And yet they've...
Well, because it's damaging. It's damaging to you as a human being.
Yes.
It's damaging as you as a human being to work in a county jail. It's damaging to work in a, you know, a prison system. It's especially damaging, I think, to work in one of these One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest places, because, you know, you're basically being required to do things that you should know as a human being are not helping, are making things worse. And to know that this person's punishment will never end. You know, more people die in shadow prisons than get released.
Right.
Just this weekend, I went to the NARSLAW conference in Atlanta, and one of the sessions that I watched was Emily Horowitz. Are you familiar with Emily Horowitz?
It sounds vaguely familiar.
She's a great artist, and just she's just picked up that she didn't have anybody on the registry in her family, but she's just picked this up as a thing. She writes books like Facts Not Fear, or what was that called? I think Facts Not Fear, basically just saying like the registry is bullshit. Anyway, she was giving a presentation. Remember earlier I talked about Ruby and Tiffany from the End MSOP program? Well, apparently because of the rescheduling, Emily and Tiffany couldn't make it to Atlanta. So Emily Horowitz basically gave a anti-civil commitment talk. And the really interesting thing about it, so the plan had originally been for Ruby and Tiffany and then Dan from inside a prison up there in Minnesota was going to call in, and the three of them were going to present. Well, guess what? Dan writes so many articles, you know, saying civil commitment is baloney. He got the Mitchell Hamlin School of Law to write an article about, you know, about civil commitment. And, you know, he's had some real success getting his word out to the world. So guess what they did?
Solitary.
They threw him in prison. They sent him away from there, sent him to prison. He's serving like, I can't remember how many months in prison. You know, and they pretty much are saying it out loud. At that facility, nobody is allowed to ever criticize the program in therapy. The therapy that they get, like, I think once a week, I think they get 2 hours of therapy. Basically, they get 1 hour of therapy a week. Each person individually gets about 1 hour of therapy a week.
Which falls below, for many of them, falls below their court mandated requirements for release. I mean, this state has been sued at least once in the past, probably more than once, but I had come across a recent article that was pointing out, okay, you guys have said they're mandated to have something like 5 or 10 hours a week therapy to even
give them once
to even start to qualify for the process of not being released, but going to one of these community houses and we're not anywhere close. We're not anywhere close. So before we talk about how effective that therapy is, which is a whole different question, you're not even getting enough of it to meet what the court has said you have to meet.
Yeah.
So you've got people that are sitting here and
yet we have states giving them like untold quantities of money every year to run these programs. So basically taxpayers are paying for this, you know, baloney system that is not making anyone better. And I mean, I know there are plenty of people who are just so hateful toward anyone with a sex offense that, you know, they don't care if we're punishing you endlessly. They think that's totally reasonable. But even if you as a human being think that, that's not what the law says. That's not what the courts say.
Correct.
Do we follow what the law says? Because you're not allowed to just not pay attention to a law because you think it's a dumb law. Like, a law is a law. And how are we letting people get away with these breaking the law?
Right.
Because nobody gives a shit.
If the premise of, among other things, if the premise of the American system and the American experiment is we have no kings, we all are equal before the law. Some are more equal than others, obviously. But the basic premise is that every man, every woman, every person in this system has equal right and equal opportunity to come before the law, to be equally judged on the merits of whatever their situation is, and go from there.
Yeah.
And we have strayed so far from that principle that in this country, you may not have a fair and equal start, but you got a fair and equal shot. And I will tell you this, the mindsets and the ideologies, I hesitate to devolve to 1930s-esque references because the internet is full of them and they have kind of come to mean nothing really.
Accurate. I'm sorry, they're a little accurate right now.
But they are these ideologies that say we have given ourselves the right to determine by our own standards, which also we may not necessarily have to reveal with any kind of transparency what those standards are. But we have the right to determine behind closed doors who is undesirable, who is not, who we can shoehorn into that category when it is convenient for some other reason, and then lay the hammer on them. And it's not just on the person. It's on the family.
Of course, the family, absolutely. Women against registry, that's our whole, whole shtick.
Right.
Right.
My father, when he first, when he was, so they maxed him out on his time in DOC. He was supposed to be released on paper in 2018. They maxed his time out to, I think it was 2020. So he, all the good time that he had earned doing 25 something years on a sentence with no merit, or they took all of that from him. The day that he was supposed to be released, I was driving down. We had a friend that was going to pick him up because she lived locally down there. She had already dropped off, you know, some clothing and whatnot. She showed up. She was going to pick him up and then hand him off to me. She shows up and they say, oh, actually, it's been revoked. We're not going to tell you why. We can't tell you why. We don't have any other information, but go ahead and leave the parking. get out of here. And then we find out, oh, this is what they're doing. They take him back to the county jail so that they can have their Soviet trial. While he's there, because when Dad goes someplace, the two of us go to work. We got two for sure. I think there was a third one. I can't remember the circumstance of that. Of guys that were in that jail with him for other things. It had nothing to do with registry of none of this. Just guys that were in the county jail.
Okay.
Got them released. Because one guy, he just didn't have somebody to take his credit card to the bail bonds and say, he's got the money. He didn't need us for anything other than, I don't know anybody in this place. I'm a, you know, an illegal immigrant from a different country, but I don't have friends and family here. I have no one to help me take my wallet to the one agency that can bail me out. So we did that. Another young man, his family's from Guatemala. He was 17. He got into some kind of situation that I don't know the full circumstance, but was some degree inappropriate, probably with a peer age or maybe somewhat younger woman. Got arrested, turns 18 in the county jail, and now the system is, you're an adult. We're going to charge you as an adult for these things that happened when you were a juvenile.
Even though he wasn't an adult when he was a juvenile?
Correct. And my father went to his attorneys and said, listen, you're going to put a pause on whatever you're doing for me right now, which is, seems to be largely ineffective anyway. Go get this man an attorney who speaks Spanish and can address this issue. This is wrong. This is illegal. It's not just wrong. You cannot do this under Washington statute. And he needs to be bailed out back to his family while you guys decide whether or not you're going to pursue this case. The kid is probably, my dad assessed him that he might be kind of a little bit on the autism spectrum.
Okay.
And so already you're dealing with a kid, and he spoke almost no English anyway. You're dealing with a child who is at massive disadvantage against a system whose sole purpose seems to be not to enforce the law, but to provide grist for the mill.
Yep, absolutely.
That kid was released. His mother called me, his brother called me and translated for her and said, you know what? We had no idea what to do. We didn't even know that he was in jail for the longest time. He disappeared and we couldn't find him. Thank you for getting our son, my brother, out of there, because we had no idea what to do. And this kind of bullshit is constant. It is predatory upon the members of society. Now, and let me make clear, neither myself or my father have any tolerance or patience for people who decide to wake up in the morning and go run amok doing hood rat stuff in the streets that is damaging and harmful to their communities, their neighborhoods, their family, the state they live in, etc. If you've decided that that's how you're going to live your life, trust me, there's a cell waiting for you. But if you're a person who is at disadvantage intellectually, legally, financially, socially, whatever, and to large degree, you are trapped in a system that's about to devour you because you don't know how to fight and you have no allies to fight with you, that's a whole different ball of wax. A little bit of a soapbox there, but, you know, we work in the arts, but we try to do good elsewhere where we can when we're not dealing with people with paintbrushes.
Yeah.
And my father has done that consistently for 25, almost 30 years now of finding the right people. Not everybody wants to be helped. Not everybody is ready for help. But the ones that are, the ones that are willing to put their, you know, their shoulder to the plow, if you will, and earn a second chance and do the best that they can with what they have, go back to their families, go back to their communities, make amends, and engage in that change of mind, that metanoia, and try to contribute. Not just try, but succeed in contributing.
Yeah.
This is supposed to be the land of opportunity and the land of second chances. We've had presidents specify that America is the land of second chances. Well, yeah. then act like it. From top to bottom, act like it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of the time we're saying one thing, but what people are actually thinking isn't the thing they're saying out loud, right?
Of course.
They're you know, I run into people who, you know, they'll tell me, like, I remember I once had a conversation with a woman, just was like a friend of a friend at a picnic somewhere. And when the opportunity to talk about the bullshit of the registry comes up, I'm going to take that opportunity. So I started talking about, you know, just basically how many people are watching porn, watching lots and lots of porn, and how much illegal porn is out there, and how that's pretty much just a feeding ground for people, you know, being put on the registry. And, you know, she, and I think I probably mentioned in there somewhere that my partner is one of those people who, you know, watched too much porn and got himself in trouble. And she started right away with this, well, you know, basically it ended with, she believed that everyone in the registry should just be castrated. And I was like, excuse me? There's a 9-year-old girl on the registry. Well, she's not 9 anymore, but there's a young lady got put on the registry at age 9 for playing doctor with her 5 and 6-year-old brothers. You think she should be castrated? And she just would not back down. She was so dedicated to this idea that, you know, a sex-related crime was like the worst thing that a person could do and just made them subhuman. So some people are just stuck in a mindset. But I think most people are not that far on the, you know, I think most people are swayable. We just aren't having enough conversations, in my opinion. So I want to just call out a few things I put in the chat, just because there's a lot of good stuff in the chat. So the first one, the Restorative Action Many Truths program, I sent something out about the Many Truths program. It's an art program, you know, it's like, hey, everybody, it's asking people to do what your program, what A Touch of Light does, basically giving people art as a as a conduit for healing. They already accepted a whole bunch of applications. So this is the sort of the showcase of, it's going to be an online showcase of the different kinds of art that people created for that program. I just wanted to let everybody know, because we're talking about, well, we're not really talking about the art, but we're, the basic bottom line is art. Then the next three things are audio files from war rooms. So the one I referred to earlier about and MSOP, these are the two women, Ruby and Tiffany, who, you know, basically helped the guys in that, in the Minnesota prison, Minnesota Shadow Prison protest. Then Thaisa Carfalho-Mick, she's the one from Larned who was told, you're too nice, they're going to fire you. And sure enough, they did fire you. And then this last one isn't really about civil commitment, but I know you will find this one really fascinating. So Gerald Blanchard is a therapist, and he came on the show, I don't know, a month or two ago. And like every minute of what he was saying, I was like, I wish I could just like pump these words into like the speakers at the mall so that everyone would just listen to this on the speaker. The first thing he talked about was, he talked about the work he'd done with men in prison. And these are people who had, you know, done a terrible, terrible crime. You know, they were attracted to children. And so the first thing he does is he just talks about the work that he did with these men. And he just did, I thought, a really excellent job of helping people like empathize with people that we have not been given any, like society doesn't raise you to be able to have empathy with someone who's attracted to minors, right?
everyone is supposed to just be so disgusted with that idea that we won't even think about it. So he talked about all the work he'd done with, like, I don't know, 275 minor attracted persons in prison. And he just sort of, he just talked about it in a way that let you have empathy for them. Like, for example, if you know that you're attracted to minors, your entire life, everywhere you go, you know that everyone thinks you're the worst person, right? You can't ever talk about that. I mean, who would you talk about it with? Who could you trust to tell them these things that you're thinking in your brain? No one, which means that you were feeling like garbage and you're all alone. So, and then he talked about how many of these men had themselves been abused as young people. And he said a lot of the time, I can't remember how he described this, but my shitty retelling is, if you are abused as a young person, sometimes it just like kind of cuts off your emotional growth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it sort of stilts your emotional intelligence. So then even though you age, even though your body ages, you don't emotionally mature. And so a lot of these men are kind of stuck in, you know, 8-year-old brain or 13-year-old brain or 10-year-old brain. That's who they connect with, because that is the age that they were when their emotional growth got stunted. And so I don't know that he said this is why they're attracted to minors, but certainly it's an interesting thing about them that we should consider.
Well, we see this. So in part of my side work, I do some work with the homeless communities here in my city, and in having conversations with my father, we started to see really close behavioral parallels between the men, the actual residents of this place he's in, and the opioid addicts that I work with a couple of days a week. And it's that precise phenomenon what we're dealing with. And like I said, I do not have a clinical background. At this point, I guess I have what they call lived experience these days.
Yep.
That's
we've got
about
lots
it.
Of lived experience.
Right. So regardless of what the traumatizing event was, whether it's heinous sexual abuse or somebody let you have meth when you were 4 years old.
Yep.
We're dealing with people whose neurological development has been slammed to a halt for some reason at some age that is significantly younger than they are now. And they have had no meaningful neurological development from that point forward.
Yep. Yep.
And
yeah,
the type of trauma, I think, pretty clearly sort of points to the type of behavioral outcomes that they're going to steer themselves into in the future as they age without, you know, a realistic and nuanced approach to how do we help you actually grow up?
Yeah, right. And we're doing the opposite. Right. In this country, if you are the victim of any kind of sexual abuse, nobody's making that easy to talk. No one's giving you opportunities to talk about that. No one's making it like not taboo to talk about it. No one's making you feel non-guilt, you know, feeling confident in yourself. And so people don't tend to work it out. They tend to stuff it down, stuff it down, stuff it down. And, you know, I think there's two things that happen when you stuff it down. Some people stuff it down and kind of quit thinking about it, or forgive themselves, forgive the perpetrator, and move on with their lives. And I think that's the healthy way to to do it. And some people just keep feeling yucky. They either feel yucky about themselves or they feel yucky about the other person. They just feel yucky about everything. And, you know, every once in a while, you know, maybe certainly once a month, I get either a phone call or an email from a hater, you know, someone who was abused when they were four, and they've been just feeding that wolf for the last 50 years. And now they're the ones saying everybody who ever committed a crime should be castrated.
Right.
Because and that's what they've been telling their brain the whole time.
I think it's important to acknowledge those people suffering too. I mean,
absolutely.
We're here, you know, we're here largely discussing those that are registry affected or shadow prison affected. But look, the bottom line here is that we have in our culture a terribly, terribly broken approach to the question of human sexuality.
Yes.
And how that should be channeled in the most appropriate, pro-social, physically healthy, mentally healthy, spiritually healthy ways. We're so far off any kind of reasonable track that those of us that are functional in those regards, the gravity of the dark side of all of this stuff pulls at everybody. You know, we've seen I know there's a number of states now that are pushing to legislatively ban pornography. Personally, more power to you guys. Go for it. There is such a damage that kind of unfettered access has, as you kind of alluded to, your partner who got into some stuff and slid into other stuff from the sounds of it. I'm not trying to make assumptions too much here.
Well, but, I mean, he slid into the 15 to 17 year old category, which is such a small slide. You could not know that you did that slide, because who can tell a naked 17 year old from a naked 18 year old?
Right. Especially when we consider the amount of trafficking that goes on these places, the amount of drug use, the amount of predatory behavior to feed new young women into that industry. It could go on and on about the damage that these things have done to us as a culture.
Yeah.
That have skewed everybody's perception of, you know, how should we be engaging as human beings in relationships? I mean, sexuality is a core component of people. And obviously there are healthy channels and outlets, and obviously there are significantly less healthy ones. But I see, on the whole, very little work to try and somehow steer us back onto, you know, a corrected course that we won't see it in our lifetimes. I mean, this has been building for 50, 60 years at least.
Well, I mean, I think there is a chance that it's going to end in our lifetime. And the reason I think that is because they're getting so, the net is getting so large. And the people that are getting sucked into it are just regular, like, it's a person who couldn't tell 17-year-old from an 18-year-old. At the point where people are getting put on the registry for going on an adult dating app or, you know, using their telephone to take pictures of themselves and sending it to someone that they want to see them, and then they're getting put in prison, like, okay, someone is chatting with me, and I'm just, someone wants to stay after and talk with you. And I suggested, could I just pause the recording? You could talk to him right now. And he's like, anyway, just Don't let me forget that close to the end of the thing. Okay, but everybody, I'm so sorry. We did the thing again where you guys couldn't chat in the chat. And it's been funny because, like, this is a big topic and we've had a lot of things, but no one's chatting. And I just realized that's because we forgot to reset the thing. So anyway, I'm totally distracted now, but I want to finish the other two things that this guy talked about. So the first thing was just helping us understand the mindset and just the patterns he saw in these men. And I think he did a fantastic job, for me at least, being able to really empathize with what these people were going through. And also, you know, for some of these people, I know it seems crazy, but generally speaking, I think it would be fair to say that if someone is abusing a young person, they're not doing it with meanness and poking with sticks and whipping. I think they're normally doing it with trying to entice you, you know, trying to be nice to you. And so that kind of messes with your brain when sex and someone showing you love get added in together. He did a really great job with the first half hour, just helping us all have empathy. Then the second part was all about restorative, Native American restorative circles and how, so if someone in one of these Native American communities gets convicted of a sex crime, because they're in their own little bubble, they're living on a reservation, they can say, no, we're not sending you through the courts. They get to do it themselves. And he described kind of the way they do it. You know, they basically get the whole community in a circle and they talk about the thing and everybody says what they need to say and they work it out with just niceness and, you know, actual community. And after this process, they assign the person basically what you need to do to pay back your community that you've harmed. And one of the things he described they would tell these men to do is visit the homeless. Or not the homeless, the people who can't leave the house. What do you call that? Shut-ins.
Mm.
And so, you know, he described one particular man who had no car. So he had to walk, you know, every time he was going to visit a shut-in. And the whole community was trained and expected to say hi to him, right? So all day long, he's walking to and from his volunteer job that he's doing to serve the elderly in this community. And people are yelling, you know, thank you and hi, whatever. And people are just being nice to him all day. And then he's spending time helping someone, right, who appreciates his help, because if you're a shut-in, I'm sure you're lonely as hell. And anybody visiting you, you're thrilled. And, you know, it was just like, so the community gets to see this person giving back. The person gets to give back, which gives him some joy. People are nice to him instead of shitty. And it was like, huh, that would really be very different. That would make a very different society if that's the way we did it. And then the third half an hour, he talked about psychedelic therapy and there's a psychedelic drug, Ibogaine, that helps quell addiction. There's a psychedelic drug that kind of pushes up empathy. And he has used some of these drugs to help people who are, you know, struggling with this kind of thing and had great success with it. So who knew that there's a drug that builds empathy or makes your empathy work harder. And he's like, a lot of these men didn't learn, you know, they didn't grow up to learn these types of things. And, you know, they need, just because they didn't learn it as a child, because maybe they were abused and, you know, things were a hot mess, doesn't mean that they can't learn it. And everybody needs love, right? Everybody needs to feel human. And, you know, it was like the best combination of commentary I'd heard for a long time. All right, Mike has his hands up. Unmute, Mike.
Okay, I've got, I don't know, three or four questions. I'll keep it brief. Okay, first one is a comment. When I came out of MOSOP, I electively, once I was done with probation and, you know, all that, I went to therapy on my own. Now, my therapist was surprised at my test scores because I had a very clear-cut view of what I shouldn't do. But MOSOP left such a void that I really didn't know what to do right. You know, because everything I did was wrong. And yeah. I learned very well everything I did was wrong. So that's more or less a comment. But my MOSOP was 25 years ago. I'm hoping they've changed some of that. I don't know. Now, second one is kind of I want a little feedback, but the way shadow prisons or civil confinement is done now seems to be really definitely negative. I've never heard anything good. Is there any possibility that if they were restructured with a clear-cut therapy and a path out, that civil confinement might have value?
I can see value. I mean, if they were giving them actual therapy, like more therapy and good therapy, and if the program wasn't designed to make them fail, because the current programs are not, they're not designed for the men to succeed, because if they were designed for the men to succeed, some of the men would succeed, right? All you got to know about civil commitment to know that it's bullshit is just ask them for the, like, of all these men in here, how many of you actually fixed? And if the answer is almost none, then why are we paying you all this fucking program. Money?
Yeah.
Like, what do you deserve all this money for?
Yeah. When I was in college, if so many students failed a test, the teacher threw out the test. You know.
The teacher threw out the test. Yep.
Because something was flawed. But I mean, so you're, to me, it seems like we're not always, we don't have to necessarily be against the civil confinement, but we are definitely against the way it's done now.
Oh, hell yeah.
And I know.
There are people who take themselves to civil commitment. I mean, there are people who turn themselves in because they don't want to do something bad and they can't stop themselves from doing it. And they check themselves in. This is not what we are seeing here. This, like, in some states, how empty, like, does the civil commitment have beds is what makes them, like, you can measure the difference in the number of referrals to, in the number of people sent to shadow prison. You can measure it based on the beds emptiness situation. And that should tell us everything we need to know. And I'm sure they know this, right? The people running this program know that.
There's an element to which, you know, we've dealt with a couple of programs in Europe through the arts side of things. And, you know, I think Europe's model for a variety of carcerally related topics is certainly more in vogue than it used to be. But what we got consistently talking with them is that the core, one of at least the core premises of their model is, unless you, the prisoner, regardless of why you're there, unless you have either been sentenced to be executed or literally sentenced to an LWOP, you're going to come back to the community at some point. And our responsibility, while we have custody of you, is not
help you be better.
Correct. It's not to sit here and heap insult upon injury when it comes to
make you feel like garbage every minute of every day.
Yeah.
Not our let job anyone be is nice to you. Fire you. Fire yeah, the therapist that's too nice to you.
to reintegrate as smoothly as possible back into the community and back into society in a way that contributes to your long-term functionality as a person. It's not to sit here and throw you behind bars and beat you and scorn you and mock you and destroy your sense of self and your sense of identity, and most importantly, to destroy your sense of hope.
Yep.
People that have a hope, regardless of what it is, have a mechanism for metanoia. They have a mechanism to change themselves in pursuit of that hope. If you strip that away from a person, which these shadow prisons are especially effective, if you strip away the last glimmer of hope from a person's life.
Yeah, that doesn't make it better.
It doesn't. And then you're shocked when they behave like an animal because you've said to them you don't have any other options but to be one. Well, that's a failed test. That's on you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That is on you. That is that test was so awful, no one could pass it. That's what a shadow prison is. It's something that's so awful, no one can fix it.
Mike, you had two other points I'd love to hear.
Well, yeah, actually just one more. I'm just curious because I'm trying to start something here locally, and it's just kind of a brainstorm that just a group of people that I'm going to say are less than desirable. You know, I don't care if they're registrants or not, but where we do volunteer work to help people. How did you get yours off the ground to get that done? Because I'm finding that, you know, it's taken me roughly 3 years, 2.5 years, just to get permission to weed eat at a cemetery. Now, I'm actually off of the registry. I was successful in my petition. But
wow.
I have found more barriers since I was removed than when I was on it, which is really ironic, I guess. But
what do they use for their why you can't? If you're off the registry, how do they say no? They just say you once were on the registry, therefore?
Pretty much. This is owned by a church. The cemetery is owned by a church who has a football field that touches the property line.
Oh, for God's sake. Can we just get over the idea that every dot on that map is someone who sits at the edge of the fucking park and watches the people all day? Like, people, well, that is not how it's done. Like, so Minnesota did a study where they showed, they studied 25 years worth of things that had happened to children, and then they compared where the thing happened to the address of the participant. Never once did proximity have a part in it.
Right. Well, I got permission. So, you know, eventually through talking to several people, and I was referred to the person in charge of the cemetery maintenance, who for some reason hasn't been able to get back with me since the beginning of summer. Well, you know, the season's about over now. So, but I mean, so even though I got permission, I keep running into these roadblocks to where I can do something productive.
And here's the next question that I have. How have we created a society where people are rewarded for that kind of treatment of a human being? They think they're right. These people who are treating you that way, these people who are treating all of us this way, they believe that they're the good guys. How did that happen?
You know, when all this started, it came down from higher up through the person that, you know, monitored the parish or denomination. And it was pretty much put out that I can do no acts of charity or kindness that in any way connects them to the, you know, what I'm doing to the church.
They don't want some asshole to say this church is letting this, like, Oh, yeah, gross. But, it's just so gross.
But
can I address each of, I hear yeah, three please. Principal things here, Michael. So let me, the first question you asked was, how do we get off? And it came down to two things. First off, we have been putting in the work with various artists for several years to begin with. And what the part of the outcome of that is that we had built up a body of work.
Did I ever get to see some work? Do you have I tried to find a website.
Our website domain recently changed. I will shoot that to you because it's no longer
put
what it
in
was.
The chat.
Yep.
I'm sorry I didn't ask about this earlier.
Oh, it is working. Okay, perfect. So when we launched, I had about 50 or 60 pieces of art in my possession from various artists. And it was enough to do a show, but I didn't have any place to do a show. And I was walking her. I probably spent 2 months knocking on doors, going to galleries, talking to people, quickly finding out that, professional art galleries are about making professional money. They're not about charity. They're not about, unless you're already in their charity pool or something like this, right? So this is exactly how it happened, Mike. I was walking down a section of a street one day, and I had all this art. I had been burning my shoes off trying to find a place that would take the art, and I was sitting there praying. I know we've got an opportunity. I don't know exactly how it's going to come about, but we've got enough to do a show. Please open a door somewhere that will take us. And I shit you not, I turn the corner and there's a gallery that says Artists Wanted. This sounds like a bullshit Hallmark story. It is not. That is exactly what happened. And I went That's in cool. there and I was like, so the sign, because it's not just me. They're like, oh, you're an artist. Great. And I was like, I'm not an artist. But I got a bunch more with me. They're just never going to come to the show. And then they wanted to know, okay, well, what's going on? And again, miracles. They were having a board meeting that day. I wasn't planning to spend 4 hours at this gallery. But I did. Because the guy that I talked to, God opened his ears.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh my God, we've got to have you guys. You guys are great. How long have you been doing this? A while, but technically not really all that long. Well, that's fine, man, because we just need artists in here and we would love to have you guys. And he had me sit there about an hour and a half later when the board came in and pitched the board on being involved in the show. And what I was told at that point was actually, unfortunately, because of the landlord situation within this building, blah, 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 we got to close our doors. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. And then, again, this sounds like a Hallmark movie. It is not. You can talk to the board members that were sitting at the table. They said, actually, we're going to be going to the Seattle Center in a premium location. Would you like to come and do our opening show? Hell yeah, we would.
Oh, that's awesome.
Look a gift gallery in the mouth. That's how we got started. Because we were putting in the work ahead of time, building up some momentum, and praying about opportunities, real ones. Not opportunities that would slap us in the face the minute that we were inconvenient to them.
Mm-hmm.
But people that would open the door and keep it open and be glad to have us. And promote us as well.
Yeah. What a just divine intervention.
That's exactly what it was. And so, Michael, that's what I would say to you. You're already doing the work, put in the prayers. If you're knocking on doors and they keep slamming, dust your sandals off and keep moving, man. Because there will be some place that says, you know what? Normally we wouldn't take a chance on you, but apparently today we're taking chances.
Honestly, Mike, have you ever considered like writing this up in a letter and like making your point? Because I've heard your points, right? I've been here every step of the way. I've known you for some years, and I think I think anybody who says no to free Mike.
Let me close on one quick other thing, and I'll loop it back to a story about my dad. My dad has made it his business over the 25 plus years of his incarceration to help people that have come to his table and said, you know, sir, this is my situation. This is my resources. This is who I got backing me up. These are the challenges I face. I'm not, you have a reputation as being the smart guy on the block that helps people figure out their situation and get out, get things done. Can you help me? And his criteria for that has been, first off, whatever you were doing that got you here, put that away. You're done with that. If you want my help, that's going to change your life radically, then you need to meet my standards of how we behave and how we engage in the community and how we earn our second chances every day and how we give mm-hmm. back. So if you could pass that first sniff test, then sit down at the table and let's talk. Now, at a certain point, because he's done this with at least hundreds, if not 1,000 or more people over that span of time, at a certain point, the Department of Corrections sent one of their minions to him and said, look, man, you got to knock it off. Because we know you're helping these dudes. And they're all doing well. But we don't know if that's them or if it's just you in the background. So please stop helping these dudes because we can't make an assessment on how functional. And my father turned to that DOC guard and said, I am an American citizen. And no person will tell me that I am not allowed to help a fellow American citizen succeed.
Well, a fellow human being. You don't have to be an American citizen for me to be nice to you, but yeah.
They sent two men into his cell and they beat the shit out of him. And then they threw him in the hole for 9 days while he bled with no medical assistance. And they, from the sounds of it, just assumed that he would die there. My dad is a tough son of a bitch and he didn't die. So they had to put him back on mainline. So Michael, when someone tells you, well, you're not allowed to do volunteering work. You're not allowed to help the community. I'll alter my language just this one time. Fuck that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, Mike, you should just consider writing up your whole story and just sending it to people because you're right. You know, if someone is going to judge you based on something that happened however many years ago.
Yeah, 1999 was my conviction date. I was released off of the registry somewhere around 2002,
you know. So this was years ago. Years ago.
I mean, it's
Anyway, I think you should write a letter and just everywhere you want to talk to him, send him the letter because maybe, you know, they read a handwritten letter and have some like humanity. Just a thought.
Yeah, I'm just, I mean.
I got my dad to quit calling me a communist and telling me he loved his politics more than his family. He gave me a hug this last holiday and said, I'm so glad you come out here for Father's Day again. And I said, I'm so glad you don't call me a communist. And we laughed and hugged.
Well, that's a step in the right direction, you know.
Anyway, yeah. I'm a very good editor, Mike, and I would love to help you write a letter to say, okay. Like, I have some volunteer time, and it's good for people to give, you know, it's good for people to help people.
Yeah.
It's good for all people to help people. So why are you not letting me help people?
Okay, part of what I'm thinking is, you know, modeled after Gays for Good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you and know, I have talked about this.
Yeah. And
I love that idea.
I looked up, And I'm not trying to be someone else, but I'm trying to figure out what's worked and then tweak it to what I want to do or what the community wants. But the underlying goal is, I mean, we can do websites and all these meetings, but until people actually interact and see us as humans,
I agree.
We're going to have a real hard time breaking through this. Everybody on the list is.
Yep. I mean, yeah, I agree. And that's why all of my ideas are forward facing. Like, we can't just keep talking in vacuums, right? Because although honestly, eventually this is going to topple on its own because they're just getting so greedy, right? The number of people who know someone on the registry is increasing every year. And there's going to come a point where everyone's going to know someone on the registry. But I think it's going to be more like gay rights, where it wasn't until the people who were hiding in the closet said, this is dumb, we got to be brave. And they all came out on the same day and whatever. Actually, no, I don't think it was the same day. It is now, though. That's why I think the...
Well, you know, I mean...
Because so many people that I talk to just one-on-one are like, yeah, I see your perspective. I've been thinking this myself. But they're not talking about it with each other because no one makes it safe to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot more people than we know who are going to see this for what it is. I mean, and especially lately, you know, especially Trump just signed that executive order authorizing civil commitment for drug users, drug addicts, homeless people, and people with a mental disorder to be named by the person who's making videos dropping poop on American cities. Like, we should all be paying attention to this because the net is widening. The way that they have been treating people in the registry for the past, you know, lot of years is giving them a platform or a pattern. You know, they're practicing on us.
I don't want to sound paranoid, but I can't help but believe, regardless of my political leanings, maybe I won't be in the first group to be rounded up.
Oh, you'll be early.
I'm going to watch, you know, and yeah, I'm not.
Yeah, we're all going to be on that list.
But I'm not
100%.
You know, unless we can change, I think you know what I'm trying to stammer through. Unless we can change our image, we will be the type of people that don't belong in public.
Yep.
So, I mean, that's part of what I'm trying to do with how do I get this idea to something, which, I mean, I'm just going to keep working. I got to find somebody that'll listen. I mean,
I would love to involve you in the Bravery Day idea. So can I tell you what happened with that? My best idea, my like, no one's going to not have empathy for this woman idea. I've lost her. I didn't label her phone number. So I got to like search back through. I don't remember whether it was a call or an email. I know what state she's from. And really I should be able to do it, but it's going to be a big mess. I gotta do a lot of looking and I don't really want to look. And after I lost that one, then I just went, I'm so scared that I'm not going to find her that I don't look for her. It really doesn't make any sense.
You know, I don't want to take up if somebody else wants, but we never hear success stories, you know,
mm-hmm.
And I'm not trying to toot my horn too much, but
no, I would love to use your success story.
You know, not a whole lot of people get off of the registry.
Yep.
And
hardly anybody gets out of shadow prisons. I saw a graph just last week, leap weekend. It was how many people had gotten out by state. The lowest of all the states, there's 20, 21 of them. The lowest of all the states is Missouri. And guess how many people we've let out?
Zero. Wow.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. You know, if everybody in my college class got a zero on a test.
That's right.
I mean.
Yep. The test is the problem.
So is it costing the state money, or are they making money?
Well, both. But that's the question, right? I've spent quite a bit of time on prison policy. Who can remember the thing I'm talking about? The one with all the great graphs and all the data. I think it's called Prison Policy Initiative. Yeah, there we go. I love Prison Policy Initiative. I mean, it has so much great stuff. There you go. Thank you, Alex. They have lots of great videos. Oh, and in fact, everybody, let's just go to this website right now together, because I want to talk about it real quick, like, if no one minds. When you get on this page, the first graph down there is how many people are locked up in the United States. I cannot seem to find on this graph, like, where are the porn watchers? Where do they sort porn on this thing? And I was, I can't imagine it's a small number. Like, I get a lot of calls for people who looked at porn. So where are they? And similarly, what do they call it when you get, you know, swap up in a sting operation where you were, you know, on an adult dating site, looking at a picture of an adult woman, and then the adult woman pretends to be a 15-year-old. It turns out they're not a 15-year-old, they're a cop, and they're really pushy. They don't let you, like, a lot of people try to leave, and the cops are just, like, anyway, where are they? Do you see what I'm saying? Like, shouldn't there be a lot of them? I don't get it.
Well, yeah, I mean, as common as what you can pull up with, you know, on internet, I would think.
I know, there's so much illegal porn, and they never take it down. So it's all, every piece of porn that's ever been up, some of the porn that's on the internet, especially the little bitty kid porn, is from a raid that the feds did in downtown Manhattan in 1972, before the Democratic National Convention. They raided downtown, I think, Manhattan. I might be getting that part wrong. And they found some, like, kiddie porn in the bookstores in 1972. That porn is still on the internet. And every time they arrest someone using that porn, they pay the now 47-year-old adult woman who was a young person in the video, and they pay her a fee. How is this not illegal? Like, I don't get it. I'm sorry, I got us off track. did we ever get some pictures? So I find a video, Dan. I find a video of ATL something. Alex has some. Sting cases sting cases are always reported as violent offenses. It's 172,000. Okay. Sting cases are always reported as violent offenses. So let's go look at that. Violent offenses. Yeah, this 11,000 there. And the 144,000 there. Now, how about porn? Anybody know? Where does porn go? Porn, Alex, you answered my question. Porn is the rape, sexual assault category. Other public order. Other public order. Yeah, such baloney. Because honestly, this is what everyone should know. Everyone, there is a lot of you. You are watching a lot of porn. And like, everyone should be terrified. I read an article the other day. I got to go look. I don't do a very good job of like writing down important information. But I saw an article the other day that was talking about basically, I think it was saying, we can come arrest a lot of y'all, but we don't. I think it was basically saying like the coverage, the amount of people's computers they could find a naked image of a 50 to 17 year old on was large. And they're just not arresting them all. Okay. Uh-oh, someone said something a long time ago and I didn't know it was there. Someone said, real therapists cite, he says, no, capital no, real therapists cite that the science shows that treatment only works in the community. Oh, that is very interesting. Ah, James says he volunteers or helps out with a farmer's market in his community. And he's been doing it since the summer season. That's not a terrible idea. I mean, and honestly, I wish you could just like put out an ad and say like, hey, I'm a nice old guy. I want to come do some nice things for somebody. Like I have a history, you know, I have a years old, you know, conviction that I'm a different person, right? Even if I did a shitty thing, like we can all learn to be better. Anyway, okay. It's 8:32. I don't want to keep people anymore. Okay, someone says, it's the principle of this sex registry ordeal. You say the word consider. Did you ever consider trying or testing the spirit? Forgiveness is good. Yes, how many forgive unless one has principles? Sometimes I don't understand the things that he says, but yes. The registry is stupid. Civil commitment is terrible. I sit on two coalitions to end civil commitment. And every single sentence I hear about it is just, it should be embarrassing for us as a humanity. Like, why are we teaching people that treating someone this way is helpful in any way? Just terrifying.
The existence of these kinds of things is a black mark against, I think there are many people who, if you were to walk up to them and try to talk to them about registry issues or anything in the category, their first response, much like, you know, the woman you mentioned, is just wood chipper those people.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time,
yeah,
if you were to sit down and discuss with them the kinds of abuses that occur, the kinds of harm to the community, the kinds of harm to, okay, maybe you're not on the side of perpetrators. That's totally fine. Fully understandable. But that would at least indicate to me you are on the side of law enforcement. Do you want to see law enforcement officers becoming mentally damaged by the exposure that these kinds of facilities and the darkness that happens there seep into them?
Mm-hmm.
If you're back to blue, which is fine, understand that this harm is not relegated just to the people that are confined.
That's right. That's right. Anybody who works in one of these facilities.
Anybody who steps through those gates and has to spend more than 15 minutes before they get the heebie-jeebies and never come back.
Amen,
the
Mike.
Poison in there gets into you.
Yeah, Mike just said, I think the number of people that are incarcerated in this country is also embarrassing. And that is 100% true.
Yeah.
Okay, it's 8:35. I'm going to let you all go. Daniel, I have had such a lovely time. I watched that video with you, a younger version of you. I didn't get to listen to it because I was just watching you. But it was nice that you could actually see some art in there.
Was this the PBS video?
I don't know. I wasn't able to actually listen. I was just watching it.
Fair enough.
Because, you know, it seemed like I should be looking at art. I should have shared it with the whole group. But, I did. I put it in the chat.
Okay.
Anyway, speaking of the chat, let me show you all how to save the chat because, you know, you might want to go visit the A Touch of Light. A Touch of Light. So ATOL.org.
ATOFL.org.
A Touch of. Oh, of. You have the whole of.
Yep.
A Touch of Light. Okay. Anyway, save the chat. Open it up. And then the upper right-hand corner, you got a thing that says three dots. And you say save chat.
Thank you, Michael.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Thank you definitely for your time. I really enjoyed talking to you, and let's connect in the future. I think you had some thoughts about some things, and I think we both got busy and we never got further on those thoughts.
Absolutely. And
but I have a lot of, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And Alex wants you to stay on for a quick second.
I'm happy to do so.
What was the other thing I was going to say? Oh, I hang out with a lot of people who work with a lot of places. So if you want to if you need a connection to grow A Touch of Light into another building or something, let me know.
What I will say this, we're always, and this is irrespective of when we work with an artist, the conversation is not what are you in for? It is, what are you trying to do with your life? And what are you trying to do with your art? Right.
Yeah.
And then from there, we will make our decision on whether or not we want to represent someone, we want to show them, et cetera, et cetera. Who are you trying to be in the future? Not who are you? You're not the worst.
Well, and honestly, here's the thing. Why does it matter? It's art. You don't have to approve of every single thing that Vincent Van Gogh did to buy Vincent Van Gogh art, right? It's art. Just let the art be its art.
Yep.
You know? Yep. And if it lets you have a little bit of more empathy for a person who needs some empathy, that's a win too.
Absolutely.
Anyway, all right. I love you all. Thank you for coming. And I'm just going to leave the room, but I won't shut the thing down. Oh no, I can leave the room. Chuck, please don't leave the room for a second because Alex and Dan want to have a quick conversation. Is that okay with everyone? All right. Bye, the rest of you. I'll see you in 2 weeks.
Hey, Chuck, can you stop the audio, the video recording? Hey, Dan, just waiting for Chuck to turn off the audio recording. I mean, the video recording.
Sorry about that. I didn't unmute and I was talking. So no, I can't stop the recording, but Anne will be the one to edit it. And she always trims off the stuff prior to the meeting starting.
I won't have this conversation with it being recorded.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you guys can exchange information. You know, you can send a private message in the text chat thing. You can pick, instead of sending it to all, send it just to each other and exchange email addresses or phone numbers or.
It actually won't let me do that. I'm just gonna quickly put this in here. Can you give me a quick call, Dan?
Yeah, not a problem.
All right, I just texted my phone number.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I'll give you a call.
Thanks. Bye.
Sure. Thanks, y'all.
Bye.